have really opened up to the ideas that fintechs are now kind of controlling some of the primary banking relationships of people.
Welcome to the Washington Tech Policy Podcast.
The latest tech law and policy news and brightest tech law and policy experts wherever you are.
So you can stay informed on the move in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the Washington Tech Policy Podcast.
With Joe Miller.
Joe Miller.
Microsoft steps up its fight to save dreamers. Can it get Congress to pass DACA legislation to protect them? Not if President Trump and most Republicans have anything to do with it. Also, big tech companies have pledged billions to address California's housing shortage, but will it be enough? And Tyler McIntyre is my guest. Hey everybody, Microsoft is stepping up its fight to save the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program on behalf of its 66 DACA Dreamers employees. The Obama-era program grants relief to the children of undocumented migrants who have spent their entire childhood in the United States. Applicants to the program do need to meet several requirements in order to qualify for DACA. For example, they can't have any felony convictions or more than three misdemeanors. They also have to have earned a high school diploma or GED. If they qualify, Dreamers get renewable two-year deferrals from being deported and can ultimately become eligible to obtain a work permit. President Trump has said he would end the program. So many, including Microsoft, have been pushing Congress to pass legislation to protect Dreamers. But the program was established under the Obama administration through an executive memo. The courts, including the Supreme Court, which prevented its expansion, have held that the program is likely unconstitutional without action from Congress. Big tech companies are investing billions to address California's public housing shortage. It started with Apple announcing a $2.5 billion investment, followed by pledges from Google and Facebook, who pledged to contribute $1 billion apiece. But local California officials have said that the investment will not be enough to address decades of rapid employment growth in the tech sector. This growth has pushed some 28,000 people out of their homes, according to The Hill. Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders also criticized the program, calling for tax hikes, saying that it's disingenuous for tech company tax evaders, who he says created the problem, to attempt to distract from it with investments that won't be enough. Facebook, Google, and Twitter are reconsidering allowing politicians to micro-target their ads based on user location and other factors. Twitter, for one, has banned all political advertising. Google is reportedly reconsidering its political ad policy with an announcement expected this week. These developments come amid criticism from Mozilla, as well as an international committee composed of lawmakers from Australia, Estonia, Finland, Georgia, Singapore, the UK, and the United States, who have objected to micro-targeting practices across social media. Facebook and YouTube have said that they will remove content revealing the name of the potential whistleblower who disclosed President Trump's alleged attempt to require Ukraine to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden in exchange for aid. The whistleblower's complaint is at the heart of the House of Representatives impeachment inquiry into the president. Twitter, however, will continue to allow users to post the name of the whistleblower, but will remove personally identifiable information such as his or her phone number and address. Avaaz, a global advocacy organization that tracks misinformation online, issued a study of the most viral fake political news articles in 2019. It found the stories generated nearly 160 million views compared to 140 million views of fake news stories posted during the 2016 election. Some 62% of the fake stories were anti-Democrat. The New York Times reports that staffers in the New York City Police Department took kickbacks from health clinics, doctors, lawyers, and a fraud insurance ring in Queens in exchange for data from car accident victims. Prosecutors have charged 27 individuals for their alleged involvement. 51-year-old Anthony Rose allegedly directed the scheme in which 9/11 call operators sent car accident victims in low-income areas in New York City to fake call centers that directed them to partnering accident victim service providers. In exchange, prosecutors say the call centers paid kickbacks to Rose, a portion of which he then distributed to his NYPD co-conspirators. The American Prospect reports that it has tied Kyrsten Sinema to a super PAC that's been funded by telecom lobbyists. Sinema is the only Democrat in the Senate who opposes the ProNet Neutrality Save the Internet Act. The report states that Sinema directed contributions to the super PAC that ultimately funded her own campaign. Finally, beginning this week, Instagram is expected to hide the number of likes users generate from their posts. Users will reportedly continue to be able to see likes on their own posts, but not the likes of others. But the new policy will only affect some of Instagram's users. The Hill reports that YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook are also considering hiding likes on their platforms. You can find links to all these stories in our show notes. Stay with us. My guest today is Tyler McIntyre, founder and CTO of Novo Bank, a small business challenger bank in the United States that's building technology to help small and medium-sized businesses better understand where and how they're spending their money. Please welcome Tyler McIntyre. Tyler, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a bit about Novo's background and why it was conceived.
Sure. So Novo's essentially a banking platform built for small businesses. So we help small businesses better compete in the market by giving them a good understanding of how and where they spend their money, as well as integrate into all the tools that they use. So some of the big issues that we felt as small business owners, both Michael, my business partner, and myself, was that we really didn't know how and where we were spending our money, let alone having to use all these accounting tools to kind of try to figure it out, when we really only understood it in dollars and cents and coffees and airplane tickets versus meals and entertainment. So Novo essentially tries to solve all that problems by really helping out those small business entrepreneurs who feel that they don't have a banking solution for them because they're forced to use a personal account or they're pushed into commercial products.
I know the feeling. So how has fintech evolved, and what are the pros and cons to open banking, APIs, and digital banking?
Yeah, so back, I would say, not too long ago, right, a decade or two ago, banking was all about essentially controlling the data and controlling the customer relationship. But with a lot of the PSD2 and a lot of regulations coming out in Europe, you're starting to see a lot of the push towards open information, that the information is actually owned by the consumer, and the bank is a custodian of that and has to kind of share it with people who want access to it. So very pro-consumer type of approach. And so when you're looking at how this has evolved, fintech has really been able to monetize and jump on that opportunity because they're now saying we can essentially get the data that is being held at the banks and really enrich it and provide great customer experiences around that. And that's really driving a lot of the pros that you see, which is the open banking APIs are opening up better customer experiences as well as banking opportunities to some of the markets that are on banks today, right? So you see a lot of these fintechs really expanding into that space. And digital banking is offering many of the benefits of, I guess, the things that you can get in a branch without actually having to go into it. If you look at the history of kind of banking in general and how the kind of fintech back in the 1950s was around credit cards, right? Then you get into the 1970s with ATMs, then you get into the 1980s with telephonic banking, 1990s with online banking, and then kind of 2000s that we're now in, which is around mobile banking, and 2010s really about open banking, right? And all those innovations through the course and the history of banking have really been pro-consumer and moving people out of the branch and allowing them to bank where and how they want, right? And so there's a lot of pros to that, but there's also some cons, right? Open banking is also allowing for many of the actors in kind of the whole ecosystem to have access to this information. And not everybody is accessing this information for the benefit of the consumer. So you now have much more risk associated with data loss, financial, even damages or fines that have to be paid if data is misused. So it's still very, very early to kind of see and understand what are those implications as we continue to go on. But open banking also opens up the possibility that not everybody who's going to be accessing your banking data or kind of leveraging some of your banking activity is going to be doing it for the best interest of yourself.
Interesting. So how have regulations and the relationship between the fintech sector and regulators changed over the last 5 years?
Yeah, it's been a very interesting change because we were involved early on in building this product about 4 to 5 years ago. And back then, it was kind of very nebulous around kind of what the regulators thought about, you know, companies like Simple getting onto the stage, as well as other kind of technology companies providing banking services. Back then, it was banks did banking and fintechs did technology that sat on top of it. But now it's so intermingled. And so that's really where you start saying, hey, how are the regulators now progressing towards looking at fintechs and banks together, right? And how they can kind of coexist. And so what we found was that the regulators have really opened up to the ideas that fintechs are now kind of controlling some of the primary banking relationships of people and businesses, especially around Novo. And what they're trying to do now, if you look at like the OCC's Office of Innovation, is try to facilitate and foster some of that innovation. And rather than being against it and kind of only saying banks are the only people that can innovate in this space, is trying to invite fintechs into the conversation and figuring out how they can partner with other banking institutions that do have the charters.
And by OCC, you're referring to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the independent Treasury Department agency that regulates banks.
Correct. Definitely, I've seen a lot of this progression towards kind of being much more open and welcoming to fintechs. And I think that's what really has spurred a lot of the fintechs popping up left and right, is that, you know, regulators are open to this fact of saying, hey, we're welcoming you into the arena.
So now let's just do a hypothetical and say that you want to become a full-fledged bank and not just a fintech company. Now that would require a charter from the OCC, the agency we were talking about earlier, but that process suffered a setback in May when the New York Department of Financial Services sued OCC in federal court to prevent it from issuing charters. Why did the NYDFS sue? What's your take here? Can you get chartered on the state level? What's your take here?
It really boils down into the way that the U.S. is regulated from a banking perspective, right? You have both state banking charters as well as national banking charters. So from the state side, you have the essentially NYDFS, which are issuing state charters for banks in New York State. Right? The OCC is doing it on the national level. And so when you go to actually start a bank in the United States, you can pick if you'd rather be state chartered or nationally chartered as a bank. And the differences between the two, there are some nuances, but they act and look very similar, right? So by being a New York state chartered bank, it doesn't only allow you to do business in New York. You can do business online with any customer in any state. So those are some of the benefits that you can get from both charters, right, is just being able to operate and bank with obviously some nuances between all of them. Now, I guess the battle between the OCC and the states are that the OCC is overstepping what they're allowed to do and kind of stepping on the turfs of the state, right? And so the states like New York are trying to say, look, the OCC doesn't have the right to issue some of these charters that they're proposing, like the fintech charter, because that should be held on the state level. And decided on a state-by-state level. And so this has gone on for several years of many different states suing the OCC to try to say, look, this is kind of out of your scope of, I guess, what you're able to do, right, with your charter of the OCC. And so this is constantly a pushback that they have. And so the OCC tried to create a fintech charter to kind of really encourage these new fintech players, like companies like Square or Google or Apple, that are looking to offer banking services to everybody, right? And then giving them an opportunity to actually go through and get regulation instead of just partnering with them. And so that is really what you see, is like kind of this war. I wouldn't even say it's a war, but a disagreement in the courts between the state level regulators and the national level regulators, between who actually has control to regulate fintechs, right? And it could very well be that the OCC has a fintech, national fintech charters, and each state also issues their local or statewide fintech charters as well. So New York is very a good example of how this is rolled out in New York, is around kind of the cryptocurrency and being regulated as a platform in New York State as a cryptocurrency platform.
It's interesting. I was reading something today that talked about some of the history of that state and federal distinction, and it actually has its roots, according to the article I read, in the cotton industry, and how the states didn't want federal regulators controlling how they sell cotton, especially states in the South. And so they developed a system where states would have their own set of banking regulations, and then the federal level would have their own set of banking regulations. So it's just sort of interesting when you say it's not a war. it actually stems from that, according to this article that I read. So what's next for digital banking and fintech, Tyler, and what are the implications for everyday consumers?
I think you're going to really see two big things happening. The first one is you're going to start seeing the unbundling of the bank, right? So everything that you originally used to go to your bank for, you're now going to start going to other fintechs for. So, you know, your mortgage, your payments, your, you know, peer-to-peer, your student loans, your business loans, whatever it may be. But rather than going to all of them under one banking branch, you're now going online and downloading 6-7 different applications and using them independently, right? And so you see that with, if you look at some of the billion-dollar companies today, you do see that happening, right? They're hyper-focused on one market and one product, and they're growing that way. Venmo, for example, right? They're only doing payments, and now they've issued a debit card. You see companies in retirement. You see companies in essentially what used to be one product set for a bank are now becoming entire businesses. And so that's that unbundling effect. But we're also going to start seeing the rebundling effect, right? So as more and more fintechs kind of pull business away from banks, kind of the death by a thousand cuts, you're also going to start seeing other fintechs and other platforms trying to aggregate these together. So when you look at Novo, that's one of the things we're trying to do. We understand that we're not going to be the best at everything we do, but we want to be the best platform for your business. And so that means you have a depository account with Novo, and we integrate into all the tools you already use, right? We're not trying to build the next and best payroll provider, for example. We'd rather integrate into the best payroll providers on the market that businesses already use and make that extremely seamless for them to kind of interact with. And so kind of the first generation of banking, when you look at it, is about let's get the customer in and let's try to cross-sell them. And while the next generation is, now that we've unbundled a lot of that cross-selling, how do we rebundle it together to make sure that you're not checking 7 or 8 different applications to understand your financial condition? You're checking one place that's integrated to all those 7 or 8 different applications. And there's really going to be two approaches to that. The first one is going to be the approach that I was talking about, Novo, of saying, look, we don't really care who your provider is. We want to integrate and share that data with everybody. And then you're also going to look at to companies like Square, for example, who is looking at kind of branding all that and bring that all in-house under their umbrella, right? So they're trying to bring in payroll. They have, you know, their POS systems, card processing, even the capital side of things. And so they're trying to bring that all underneath kind of their own umbrella and rebundling it under Square. And while Novo's trying to kind of look at how do we build this more as an open platform where you can bring in any provider you want. So that's what I see as the next frontier for digital banking and fintech over the next, I would say, decade or so.
Well, Tyler, thanks for joining me. Obviously, there's lots to think about here, especially when we start looking at the effect that and or opportunities that this would create for current folks who are currently unbanked. So lots of opportunity to research this further. Thanks for shedding light for us.
Sure.
When we come back, we'll do an icebreaker and hear about what you're reading these days. Okay, so it's time for this week's icebreaker. What's a favorite quote of yours?
Good question. So I've kind of always struggled with this here because it's really based off my mood, right? And I think that the quote that I would use is, never attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by stupidity.
That's a good one. Who said that?
Hanlon's Razors.
Who?
Inspired by Hanlon's, let's see what this is from, jargon, slang. Good question. I guess it's debated of who said it first.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably named after Robert J. Hanlon, is a philosophical razor, which suggests a way of eliminating unlikely explanation for human behavior. It's called Hanlon's Razor.
Interesting. I've never heard that quote, but it sounds It sounds like good advice, because a lot of times when someone does something stupid, you think that it's a personal attack, but it's, you know, you can stop a second and realize that they're just being stupid. They're just being idiots. So I'm currently reading, speaking of the Civil War, I'm reading David Blight's biography of Frederick Douglass. So I'll go with Frederick Douglass, who said, "People might not get all they work for in this world, but they must certainly work for all they get," which is an important insight, because a lot of times we're working hard and we don't feel like we're getting the rewards that we think we're putting in. But that's just the nature of the beast. You may not get all you work for, but you certainly must work for what you do get. What's the best career advice you've ever heard?
Compound education is one of the most powerful forces, just like compound interest is. So the more you learn earlier in your career, the more it's going to pay off longer term. And you can kind of exponentially move forward with, you know, where you are in life, like longer term. So try to compound as much interest as you can on your learnings early on, whether that be through failure, through reading, or even through experimentation. So that way that all those dividends pay out over the course of your career.
And a lot of us are going to be working well past 65. So there's still plenty of time, folks. Still plenty of time. So what are you reading these days?
I just picked up a new book called What You Do Is Who You Are by Ben Horowitz. Obviously, Ben Horowitz is a famous VC, but it really talks about how you can kind of influence company culture by your own actions.
Well, thanks again, Tyler, for joining me. Do you have any final ideas you'd like to leave with the audience before we close? And where can we find you online?
Sure. So I'll start with where you can find us online. That's banknovo.com, N-O-V-O. And then kind of final thoughts is the world of fintech is changing very quickly, right? And there's so many different ideas out there. And if you look at the way that community banks have served communities, it's really been about the geographical reach, but as well as kind of those personas, right, that they were speaking to, whether it be, you know, the Carpenters Union or the teachers associations, et cetera. I think that there's still a tremendous amount of opportunity to build products around these affinity groups and be able to support people across all different educations, races, locations, et cetera, by building a new fintech that really can help those demographics.
And you've been listening to Tyler McIntyre, founder and chief technology officer of Novo, an award-winning banking platform for modern businesses. Tyler, thanks for joining me.
Great. Thank you.
Concludes episode 209 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment and head over to Apple Podcasts and give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out tremendously. Thanks again to all of you for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care. Washing Tech.